Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has the chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide 3 delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Don't miss Free Fire Radio weekday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to writing roots, pop culture, and unsung heroes in the North State. From 7 to 10, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR also has an incredible weekend lineup, including The Plotline, Jefferson State of Mind, Sovereign Minds, and We the People on KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at KCNR1460.com.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Turtle Bay Exploration Park is back open for exploration. See the West Coast Biennial Art Exhibition featuring diverse pieces by artists up and down the West Coast. Enjoy the Visible River Aquarium, Caverns Exhibits, Parrot Playhouse, and more. There's something for everyone to discover at Turtle Bay.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 and 1460 AM.
Orchard Nutrition Center, your local neighborhood health food store. We are dedicated to the healthy lifestyle, and we strive for a high standard to carry organic, GMO-free, and clean healthy products.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
We have certified nutritionists on staff that take pride in helping you. Supporting local, we are all in it together. Orchard Nutrition Center, Cypress Square Shopping Center, Reading.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
As Shasta County gradually reopens for business, we can all do our part to stop the spread of COVID-19 by wearing a mask when in public. Cloth face coverings help reduce the spread of germs by preventing the release of droplets when someone speaks, coughs, or sneezes. Wash your face covering often, ideally after each use or at least daily. Wash with detergent and hot water and dry on a hot cycle. Here is Shasta County Health Officer Dr. Karen Ramstrom.
Remember, wearing a face covering is not a replacement for physical distancing, frequent hand washing, and staying home when sick. Your mask protects me, and my mask protects you. Together, we can stop the spread.
For more information, including how to make your own cloth face covering, go to ShastaReady.org.
Turtle Bay Spring Plant Sale coming up on Saturday, April 3rd. Members and non-members will enjoy discounts on regular nursery prices. California native and climate acclimated plants from all around the world. Time to grow strong and healthy right in your own backyard. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Did the Redding summer heat put a toll on your vehicle? Is your paint faded, peeling, or even scratched up? It'll get worse faster than you think. You may think it's way too expensive to have painted. Well, think again. You can bring it to Maaco here in Reading and get a professional paint job and save big. With their $4.99 special, Maaco also has interest-free loans for up to a year OAC. Maaco, America's Body Shop, 3045 Crossroads Drive. Uh-oh. Better call Maaco, 226-0992. Have you been involved in a minor accident and find it's not big enough to go through your insurance company? Bring it to Maaco and get it fixed at a fraction of the cost. Remember, it's your choice where you go to have your vehicle repaired. Call Maaco for uncompromised quality, quick turnaround times, and all work backed by the National Maaco Warranty. Maaco, America's Body Shop. Stop in at 3045 Crossroads Drive or call 226-0992. Uh-oh. Better call Maaco, 226-0992.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. For this month, we're reviewing Arturo Fuentes Hemingway Classic. With curves of a supermodel, this Perfecto has a superbly balanced, toothy, and attenuated Cameroon wrapper and pairs exquisitely with a complex filler and binder that indulges the palate with citrus, coffee, cocoa, and cedar. Come down to the shop for your Arturo Fuente Hemingway Classic today. 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Don't miss Free Fire Radio weekday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding routes, pop culture, and unsung heroes in the North State. From 7 to 10, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR also has an incredible weekend lineup, including The Flatline, Jefferson State of Mind, Sovereign Minds, and We the People on KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
When you're looking to add a pet to your family, Haven Humane Society is a place to start. Hi, this is Mark from Haven to tell you that shelter pets make the best pets. With kittens, puppies, dogs, cats, bunnies, guinea pigs, hamsters, snakes, birds, and more, Haven has a pet that is the right fit for your family. We also provide education, training, spaying and neutering, dog licensing, and so much more. If you're looking for a way to help, our amazing volunteers have fun with the animals while helping us to save lives. For more information, call 241-1653 or visit havenhumane.org. Like us on Facebook and follow our progress as we work towards a day with no more homeless pets in the North State.
Readers tend to like a character who is at least superficially like themselves, but they quickly lose interest unless this particular character is somehow out of the ordinary. Orson Scott Card.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Holt.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Happy December.
Yay.
We hope you had a good Thanksgiving and are looking forward to all of the festive holidays that are happening this month. As we do in December, we are doing a Frequently Asked Questions series. So we've taken your questions that you've submitted. We've taken questions that we see commonly when we are in writing forums and other places, questions that we get asked a lot, and trying to answer them here quickly and succinctly so that you know where to go, where to move forward. So what is today's question?
How descriptive are you with characters and landscape appearances? When do you describe them? And what about the sequel? Do you describe them then also?
So let's take this from the beginning. How descriptive do you get with character and landscape appearances?
My answer, as little as possible.
There are different approaches to the idea of describing characters, and it is somewhat genre-specific, but most experienced authors will agree on a couple of things. And one of those is you do not ever give a head-to-toe description just because.
Yeah, it's not often your character is going to stand in front of a mirror and notice the color of their own eyes.
No.
If anything, people tend to be self-critical. They're going to dislike something about themselves unless they're an incredibly vain character.
So it does depend on the character. That's the other thing experienced authors can agree on. It depends on the character, what they notice, and what they would describe. So, when do you describe characters? And this will go into how descriptive you get.
When I am describing any character, it's almost never from that character's point of view. He is noticing her across the room. She is checking somebody out.
It depends on the point of view. But you need to have a specific reason for describing the character in that moment. Think about the last time you met someone. How much about them did you notice? Did you really go full creeper and do a full body scan, taking note of every aspect of their body?
I really hope if you do this, there's some sort of comedic twist at the end. You're looking at her from the back and across the bar, and you see the fantastic stiletto heels that perfectly match the short skirt and the long legs in between, the slender waist you get up to the front. The character turns around and full beard. or something just completely off the wall. It was like, oh, okay, we're going on a different path here.
Again, that's a specific plot device to use there. Number one, your readers don't want to be overwhelmed with description. It gets boring. And number two, the more vague you are, especially with your main character, the more connected your reader can feel to them.
I would say most of the time, if I'm describing a character, that character is probably going to die in the length of the scene. This is mostly because I don't want to name guard one and guard two, so I'm going to say the fat one and the one with the stupid hair. They aren't going to last long. Not long enough for me to name them, but if they have two different bits of choreography, they need to be differentiated, therefore physical attributes are an easy way to do that.
So another time to describe that goes along with there's a specific reason is if there's something atypical about that character's body. Maybe they're missing an eye. Maybe they have severe scars on their face or some kind of disfigurement that stands out that will catch your main character's eye first.
Again, when your character is noticing something about themselves, it's rarely going to be a positive note because that's how a lot of people are, especially if your main character at the beginning of your story is going to believe a lie about themselves. I just had a scene where my character caught a glimpse of herself in a mirror and she immediately turned away because she doesn't like what she sees.
When it comes to your main character's hair color, that kind of stuff, there needs to be a reason for it. So for my main character in my last book, because she likes to dye her hair, she has black hair with emerald highlights. There's a scene where she's kind of messing it up because she has a pixie cut, and she's trying to tease out those highlights to make them really stand out. So to sum up this of how and when to describe, think yourself. When you meet someone, when you're hanging out with someone, when is it that you notice something about their physical appearance? When is the last time that you met someone and immediately noticed their eye color? And do you really think in your head, oh, what delicious chocolate brown eyes those are? Honestly, no one notices brown eyes. Brown eyes are, sorry to say it, boring. They blend in most often.
If he has eyes like the sea after a storm, I don't quite know what that means, but it says something about her more than it does about him. He's got grayish blue eyes. Yay.
And that goes for a lot of your descriptions. It tells us more about the person describing them than the person being described. So if you are in a bar and watching for that really attractive person you want to hit on, and you give us a full-blown top-down description, I'm going to think you are a creeper that has stared entirely too long.
But if you're noticing height, skin color, tattoos, interesting markings, then you might be in law enforcement. You might not necessarily be there to pick somebody up at all.
You may be looking for someone to arrest.
And of course, if you're most of my characters, you are seeing somebody and their posture, where they sit, what kind of awareness they have of their surroundings, because you're assessing a threat level. You don't really care what color their skin is. You care if they watch when somebody comes in the front door.
So who is your character and what would they notice? That's how you decide when and how much to describe.
So what about a landscape?
A lot of the same principles apply here. It's when the characters would notice the landscape. If there is a new location, so they just arrived at this beautiful meadow covered with wildflowers, you can go a little bit into describing it.
One of the times when I am doing scene setting, it is intentional. I am mentioning intentional objects because then later when they pick up the vase and smash it into the bad guy's face, I don't need to describe the vase or where it is because I've already done that. A lot of my scene setting is for an upcoming fight.
That is when it's relevant to the story. The object or the thing that was described is going to be used. Remember Chekhov's gun. If you describe it, it needs to come into play somehow.
I always remember the Disney Renaissance animation style where you've got like Aladdin going into the genie's cave and you've got piles of gold and this and that and then one object in front that's traced differently.
And then you know exactly what's going to move because it's slightly brighter colors and more defined edges.
And fewer textures, you notice?
Yes, way fewer textures. And another time to describe a landscape is if there's world building to be done. In the Stormlight Archive series, there's quite a bit of landscape description because the world is different than ours. You have to describe that so your readers can get a good image of what's going on. But be careful. You can go too far.
Tolkien.
Don't go full Tolkien. Love his storytelling. His descriptions are too much. So, what about sequels? How do you describe things you've already described in a previous book?
There are two different kinds of sequels. We've talked about that before. One is an episodic where you can just pick out anyone, such as the Jack Reacher series, in which case he has basically one sentence that he uses in all of them where he gives his height, weight, and hair color. But it's very brief, and we just sort of go with it for the rest of the time.
Even if it's serial, you go on the assumption that your readers have forgotten. They will need a reminder, but not an entire breakdown. Believe it or not, there are people out there in the world that read book 2 or 3 before they ever read book 1. So you do need something, but it doesn't have to be a full-blown description. Your readers can make something up in their mind without a description. Let them. Let them use their imaginations because it makes them more connected to the story.
You don't want to lose your fans from the original book because you're wasting their time in the second book.
You do, however, want to make specific mentions if something has changed between those books. So I mentioned earlier that my main character likes to dye her hair. So in the first book, she has black hair with green highlights, and in the book I'm writing now, she has slightly longer hair and it's purple. And I make a specific mention of that change, just so I make sure the readers don't look at that and go, wait, did I miss something? I thought there was something different earlier, different before.
Yeah, you don't want them to catch you in a continuity error because you're just changing things from book to book. Acknowledging the previous book or the previous state is a way to transition with a clean slate.
So overall, descriptions are good. They can really add to your story. But don't overwhelm your readers. Brief descriptions are good. 1 to 2 things at a time, because that's what we notice.
It all comes back to, is your reader enjoying the book? Are they feeling bogged down, or are they getting immersed in the details? That circles back to how you are writing it. If you don't remember, leave it out, move on. If you are writing because you think someone else thinks you need to have this in here, that's always dangerous, especially on your first draft. Because really, what you should be doing is
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
I will put you, the writer, behind the wheel of the squad car, walking a beat, investigating crime scenes, and sitting behind a desk writing reports. So, put on your Sam Brown belt, strap on your vest, and let's go experience what cops do and learn why they do it. Patrick O'Donnell.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Holt.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Continuing our series with people with advanced skills, we are getting into law enforcement, a very common character in a lot of genres. So our guest today is Patrick O'Donnell. Welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So we know you wrote this opening quote, and that came from your book, Cops and Writers. How long have you been in law enforcement?
Okay. I just retired February 21st of this year from law enforcement. I retired as a police sergeant in the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after 25 years of service.
Wow.
Presently 55 years of age. So that's about typical across the nation. To give your listeners some context, Milwaukee is a city of about 600,000 people. There's about 1,800 law enforcement sworn members, which means they have arrest powers. And out of that 1,800, there was about 200 sergeants. I was one of them. I was a street sergeant, so I spent all of my career on the streets.
You wrote a book called Cops and Writers. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The first book is Cops and Writers, From the Academy to the Streets. I'm an independently published author. That was the fourth book that I've written. I was in the middle of the second post-apocalyptic book, and I was getting deeper and deeper into the weeds in self-publishing and going to conferences, getting to know people, and inevitably it's always, what do you do for a living? What's your day job? And I tell them, and they had just a plethora of questions. And I said, yeah, you should really just start consulting with authors, and you should be writing books about this. So I scrapped the post-apocalyptic book, and I wrote this book. I also started a Facebook group to see if there was interest in it before I invested too much time or money into this project. And the results were fantastic. People were very open to it. I've helped a lot of writers kind of write their way through maybe some plot holes or just does that really happen kind of questions. So now I just sent off the second book in this Cops and Writers series, and that's going to be Crime Scenes and Investigations. And hopefully that'll be out in September. That's what I'm shooting for.
Oh, that is awesome. And let me just say, I am part of this Facebook group, and it is fantastic.
Well, I'm glad. That makes me very happy.
So what do you see that really works well and drives you up the wall?
Most of it doesn't work well, and most of it does drive me up a wall. My wife loves shows like, you know, Hawaii Five-O, you know, all the different spin-offs of CSI. And most of them are far, far from reality. You know, it's entertainment. I guess it's not very exciting to watch a cop or a detective do 8 hours or 10 hours worth of reports after a 5-minute chase. And that's the reality of it. There was one TV show that I thought was pretty spot on, and that was Southland. Hmm. What I liked about that show was it got the gallows sense of humor. It got the banter between the cops. And it really showed the human side of things that a lot of TV shows and movies, you know, it seems like it's one extreme or another. Some of the things that really drives me crazy is most of police work that's done, that's exciting, quote unquote, is done by police officers on the street. It's not detectives.
Hmm.
Detectives usually show up after the fact. This is funny. We tease them sometimes. We used to call them third responders. But no, you decide to show up. That's nice. But the breaking down the doors, the car chases, the stuff that gets notoriety and the highest amount of liability are the first responders, the cops on the street. Say like a homicide detective. You see that a lot on TV and in movies. They respond when there's somebody that just committed a homicide. Sometimes that could be a half an hour to an hour after the police officers show up on the scene. Then a sergeant's going to show up on the scene. That's what I did. And you quickly try to maintain control of the crime scene. You set up a perimeter. That's when the yellow tape goes up that everybody is familiar with.
If there is one concept that you could make everyone understand about law enforcement, what would it be?
I would try to humanize it as much as possible. Police officers, detectives, sergeants, lieutenants, captains, etc., they're all human beings, and we're all flawed. I think they do a fabulous job, and literally you have under a second to make sometimes life and death decisions, and I can't think of any other job that's like that. They're human beings. They're professionals. They are flawed. There's all kinds of problems, just like anybody else. It's funny because law enforcement's a melting pot. You have people from every kind of walk of life you can think of that becomes a cop and use that.
You mentioned earlier the gallows humor of a lot of that type of environment. What other types of speech, lingo, or whatever, can people embed in their stories that would be accurate to the law enforcement profession?
Oh, boy. The gallows humor is a big one. I would be careful as far as using, like, cop lingo in your books because it can be very specific to department and region of the country. Some are very formal, some are informal. Personally, if I was going to write a story about, say, a detective or a police officer or whatever your story is, maybe an Avatar city might be your best bet.
Okay.
And model it after a specific city, but you wouldn't name it as, you know, like Milwaukee Police Department. It could be Metro City Police Department or whatever.
In your quote, you said put on your Sam Brown belt. What is that?
That's the technical name for the gun belt. Most people refer to it as a gun belt that are not in law enforcement.
Okay. So you mentioned earlier that law enforcement is a melting pot with personalities, backgrounds, everything like that. However, there is still a certain mindset that most police officers need to have for the job. How can a writer portray that in their stories?
I guess the best way to explain it is when I worked nights for 17 years. I worked a big chunk of that midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning in some of the most violent areas of the city. I mean, I was literally surrounded by gunfire every night. And most of the people we dealt with were either intoxicated, you know, by alcohol or other drugs. They were having the worst day of their lives. And usually that's when they would call us. Or somebody else would call and say, hey, I think that guy shot on the sidewalk over there, you know, that type of thing. What I always told my cops is there's a lot of people in these neighborhoods that really like us and they want us here. You just have to see past all the negativity. Then in the latter years of my career, I worked day shift and there's more people out there that are just normal people. Something bad happened to them and they would call us. You can find common ground with some of these people, and now your faith in humanity starts to slowly restore because it's really hard to get beat over the head night after night after night, like I said. And you forget sometimes that there's decent people in these areas that need our help, and they're very friendly, and they want us there.
So a good police officer really needs to have a little bit of an optimist in them.
Yes, because if you ask a cop, why did you become a cop? Most of them are going to say to help people. I know that sounds corny. And honest to God, that's really why they became cops. They want to help people, and 99.9% of the time, they do. But the gallows humor, to circle back to that, that's a coping mechanism. Firefighters are the same exact way. Sometimes they're worse. Anybody that's in a high-stress situation where you're surrounded by death on a regular basis.
One of the things that we advise our listeners to do is to make friends with somebody in the profession. If I have zero contacts in law enforcement, where would you suggest I start?
Well, you could start with me. I'll be your friend. You could also, if you want to be specific, like say where you live, if you want like face-to-face connection, not every department, but a lot of departments, especially big city departments, have a PIO. That's a public information officer. They might be able to help you. A lot of police departments have what they call a citizens academy, where citizens can go through an abbreviated police academy. But like I said before, there's police officers in my group. Another good group is the Writers Detective Bureau that Adam Richards runs. And there is a retired FBI special agent that's also in my group. Her name is Jerry Williams. She wrote a book called FBI Myths and Misconceptions, a manual for armchair detectives.
Do you have any final bits of advice you want to embed on our listeners as we head out?
When you're writing about law enforcement, I guess I will reiterate, if you're going to be writing about a specific department, do your due diligence. Some things that writers get wrong on a pretty consistent basis is rank. We all start out as police officers, and then from there, you can branch out either into patrol or investigations.
One thing I'll add is that there is a difference between a police officer and a deputy. They do the same job, but if you call a deputy a police officer or a police officer a deputy, sometimes they get a little not happy.
Yeah, and state troopers. You know, they don't appreciate when you call them officer, but in California they're called officers, so I guess it all depends where you're at.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Patrick, for joining us today. Again, for our listeners, you can find him on Facebook with the Facebook group Cops and Writers, also by his book by the same name.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And for all of you listeners, if there's one thing that you can take away, it's do your research, take the time. Law enforcement officers are people too, but when you are writing, just make sure you are always writing
selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
When a unicorn is slain, men have destroyed again the image of beauty that they seek. Nicholas Stewart Gray.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
October is our favorite month because we both really like Halloween. So for this October, we decided to take on the topic of monsters, creatures, things that go bump in the night.
We have been fairly academic over the summer and much of the spring. We wanted to have a little fun with this series. So we are starting with the brightest monsters that we can think of, the wholesome, the good ones. And then we are ending with the darkest monsters of all, the scary ones. As we get closer to Halloween, we're going to have more and more fun in this regard.
Yes. So let's get into today's topic. Monsters associated with good, with light, with purity. Because monsters aren't all evil, dangerous, and out to kill us. The definition of monster is usually just kind of an unusual creature outside of the norm.
Something that's been affected by magic in some way.
And unicorns fit that definition. The oldest reference was in the 4th century AD by a Greek physician. I don't even want to try to say his name. But that physician described unicorns as a wild ass as large as a horse with a white body, a red head, and dark blue eyes. The horn was about a foot and a half long, and it was red, white, and black. There really isn't any modern description of a unicorn that fits this.
I think when it started getting associated with purity, that was when all things that were good and wholesome were also associated with the color white in Europe, versus evil was dark and black. So I think they moved it toward the white. So our traditional image of a unicorn now is closer to all white, somewhat sparkly.
That description came around in about the 12th century AD. That's when they tried to bring the mythological lore of Greek and Roman beliefs into Christianity. Here's the weird thing, though. They, at that time in the 12th century, were described about the size of a goat. So small, little things instead of a wild ass as large as a horse.
And along with that image of purity was that a unicorn would only come to a chaste virgin.
A lot of these themes are in the old movie Legend that has Tom Cruise, Tim Curry, and a couple of unicorns. Weird show. But it has that kind of theme to it of unicorns are associated with sexual purity.
I mentioned the horn being sort of not only what makes a unicorn unique and sort of by definition a unicorn, but that also tends to be where a lot of the magic is held in this magical creature. And it turns out that they actually bought and sold unicorn horns at one point during medieval Renaissance time.
They were used a lot in the medieval times in alchemical pursuits as a way to cure poison, to identify poison. At least that's their belief. But what were these unicorn horns in reality?
Narwhal horns. It turns out they thought that the Vikings were particularly good at hunting unicorns because they came up with all sorts of unicorn horns. And to give you an idea of how much a horn was worth in that time period, there are records of people trading an entire castle for a unicorn horn. So the Vikings are like, narwhal horns.
They kind of look like unicorn horns.
Lop them off, bring them down. Hey guys, can I have a castle? And they did this, not once, not twice, but for 5 centuries.
Yeah, so great. So Queen Elizabeth in the 1570s had a unicorn horn. She drank out of a unicorn horn cup. And it was actually a narwhal horn. I love the history of unicorns. But it's not just in Western culture that a unicorn-type creature is associated with purity. A lot of Asian cultures have a creature similar to the unicorn. It's often called the Asian unicorn or the Chinese unicorn, but it's called in Chinese the Kilin or in Japanese the Kirin. I'm really sorry. I'm going to be butchering some of these pronunciations. I am trying my best.
I first learned it as a Kirin, K-I-R-I-N, which is a Japanese version of this. But they will occasionally be portrayed as having 2 different horns, but their manes will be going straight up in this, like, magical, defying gravity kind of thing.
And instead of being a normal horse coat that's fur, it a lot of the times is scaly. They're almost a dragon mixed with a unicorn look in the sculptures and in the art.
But they were definitely associated with goodness. They were sometimes depicted as flying simply because they didn't want to harm anything, even a blade of grass.
Another thing associated with this is it represents both male and female elements. The name itself is a split between male and female. You have the key, which is male, lin, which is female. That pattern also shows up with another Chinese-based creature associated with purity, and this is the phoenix.
Now, the word phoenix actually comes from Mediterranean, the Phoenicians, but what we're talking about is the bird creature that gets reborn in fire.
So in Chinese, the name is Feng Wang. Again, the Feng represents male, Wang represents the female. But you also have bases in, like Lee said, the Mediterranean. You have some bases of a similar creature in Egyptian mythology. We just kind of combine and call it all the phoenix now because that's what's become popularized.
Now, for the most part, what comes to mind when I'm thinking phoenix is Harry Potter, where you've got the big bird that's about the size of a peacock, long, beautiful tail, mostly red with highlights of gold throughout it. Some portray it more as an eagle, especially I think the Native American styles of that kind of character in their culture. They tend to be songbirds, as well as creatures that either when they die, they turn into ash, or they must be born from the fire in some way.
And in Christian traditions, the phoenix has become associated with Christ and the resurrection of Christ. You have Islamic traditions that have brought in the phoenix, that they see the phoenix as created by God to have all perfections. And throughout all of it, it is the rebirth, the immortality, the continuing to live and grow in perfection.
A lot of mythological creatures across the world have a lot of similarities. We're going to notice that throughout this whole series. There's a version of whatever. There's a water elemental here and a djinn here and the nymph here. There are similarities because we come up with ideas based on the world around us. The next creature we're going to talk about is based on something we all see, but not on this world itself.
While many of us grew up seeing a man on the moon, ancient traditions don't see a person. They see a rabbit.
This one was a new one for me when we were researching the different creatures for this.
So you have essentially two separate parts of the world, the Asian area and the indigenous America area, that came up with their own stories for why there is a rabbit on the moon. But all of them tend to be associated with prosperity, fertility, life, purity.
Rabbits and fertility going hand in hand is not exactly a new concept.
So in the Chinese and other Asian cultures, the moon rabbit is seen as a companion to the moon goddess. And this is the version that creates the antidotes, the elixirs, the herbs for the immortals.
Another story from the Cree Nation in Northern America tells the story of a rabbit that hitched a ride to the moon by hanging onto the legs of a crane, which is why they get all long.
The rabbit just wanted to ride the moon, so it hitched a ride with a crane.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. That one in particular explains why you can see a rabbit on the moon and why the crane's legs are so long.
In Mayan culture, the rabbit is also associated with their moon goddess, and they're frequently shown side by side.
Very much like the Chinese background. In Aztec traditions, the god Quetzalcoatl was once living as a human on Earth and thought he would die with no food or water during a long journey, and a rabbit offered himself to the god. As a reward, Quetzalcoatl put the rabbit's image on the moon for people to remember her.
The last critter I wanted to just briefly mention is the Caladrius, which is Roman, and it's an animal that's a bird associated with healing, and it was said to arrive in a king's window. I just thought it was an interesting one to kind of toss into the mix.
So the thing with purity is it's not limited to just animals. We talked about the animals. You can also look into plants, such as the world tree and the lily. Both of those in earth cultures very associated with purity.
And plants as monsters are just kind of fun anyway.
So this whole month is going to be us giving you starting points for your research, because we want to equip you with tools to find interesting things, things that you won't always see.
Or even make up your own monsters, especially if you're doing fantasy or sci-fi, something that doesn't take place on Earth. Making up your own monsters is part and parcel to the world-building process.
And that way you can write your book the way you want it to be, because we should always be
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier. The boy was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
I became a writer not principally because I'm in love with the idea of being a writer, but I'm in love with the idea of entertainment. I just want to entertain people. Lee Child.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Holt.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our master today that we will be learning from is Lee's favorite author, Lee Child. Another Lee.
Yay!
All three different spellings.
If you are listening to this episode on the day that it airs, yesterday was my birthday, so I wanted to make sure we paired this one as close to my birthday as possible because I love it so much. One of my favorite things about Lee Child is his style of writing. He is blunt, he is forthright, he is known for the Jack Reacher series, which are technically a mystery, but he's just in-your-face, short sentences, and always keeps the plot moving.
Just before we started this record, we made the comment to contrast it with the Neil Gaiman episode that we just recorded, where all the quotes from Neil Gaiman tend to be a couple of sentences long at the minimum. And then we have Lee Child, where there are several in this list that are at the most 4 words long, and it just shows the difference in writing styles. And it also shows a little bit of the difference of target audience. Lee, you share a target audience with Lee Child. I do not. So I will always take some of his advice with a grain of salt.
So the first quote that we're going to get into here is something that you may have heard more than once already, and we're only halfway through the month. It's, reading is the only thing that prepares you for being a writer. Sound familiar?
It should. Because Stephen King said it, John Green said it. I don't think we got a quote from Neil Gaiman to say it.
But I'm sure he has said it before.
Probably. You have to read. You're going to find this advice from any author, and if you don't want to follow it, that is up to you. But just understand that you are ignoring the advice of many, many great authors.
This next quote is specific to his genre especially, but I think it speaks to a lot of storytelling in general.
The end of any thriller or mystery has got to be both surprising and inevitable for it to be plausible.
That is a hard line to walk. Especially because
yes.
He's a pantser.
Yes. Being a mystery pantser myself, I can tell you that this is a very hard thing to do because you don't want it to be obvious, but you also want your readers to feel satisfied. And if the ending, if the bow on top just came out of left field and there was no setup for it at all, your readers are going to feel robbed of the story.
There's that saying of the journey is more important than the destination. I really think that's true for structuring your story as a plotter, because we want to know that the bad guy loses and the mystery is solved and the good guys live happily ever after. We read the story to figure out how they get there, not if they get there necessarily.
Yes. So the next quote is short and sweet.
Trust yourself.
That's it. That is all the advice from that quote.
But it's good advice to have. Knowing yourself and trusting yourself to make it entertaining is a huge part of actually succeeding. Writing selfishly, enjoying the process, and trusting yourself to make it work is actually a skill.
a lot of the times when I'm running into writer's block.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.